So for December of 2020, we had four Sundays, and we conveniently had four chapters of Christmas Story, two in Luke and two in Matthew. So, of course, the first 2 weeks we did Luke. The first week is kind of the backstory prior to the birth, a lot about John the Baptist, and the story leading into him, and then, of course, the announcement to Mary and coming together. Second week is actually the Christmas story that we're more familiar with. This is the shepherds and the angels. Last week, we turned to Matthew, particularly to the genealogy, and then the birth story there. And so today we do a wrap with Matthew 2, which has two major stories. One is the Magi, which makes it into our creche. And the other one is a story, again, that we don't tend to lift up, and this is the incident in Bethlehem with all the children two and under. So tonight, when we're done, I think for discussion, we can either look at this tonight's material or just, you know, maybe look at all of it. So big story again, the two Christmas stories, Matthew and Luke, reminding ourselves that one of the things that we tend to do in our society is to put the two together so that we don't really hear the nuances of each story. So this, what we've been doing is the opposite, trying to let each story tell its own story. And again, last week we began with Matthew. That was the genealogy, the virgin birth story, which at one level might not sound like they fit together, but at a deeper level they do, because they're both saying the same thing, that Jesus is in fact the Messiah, the Son of God. Today, again, the conclusion of Matthew's story, particularly the wise men. Now, in the first chapter, Matthew went to great lengths, if you remember last week in the genealogy, to link Jesus to the Gentiles. He did that in a couple of ways. He did that through the five women, four of the five women who were Gentiles. And then several times Matthew mentions from the Isaiah passage, that the Messiah is to be a light to the Gentiles. So even though Matthew is a very Jewish gospel and works really hard to link Jesus back to the Old Testament narrative, back to the faith and the history of Israel, there also is a very strong Gentile presence. And scholars believe it's because Matthew's church is actually made up of both. You've got people who were Jews who became Jewish believers in Jesus. And you also had God-fearers in the synagogues who were then converted also. So in chapter 2 now, Matthew is going to dip back into this Gentile part of the story, and he's going to develop it with the coming of the Magi. And of course, this is going to be followed by the flight to Egypt and the massacre in Bethlehem. And with that, the Christmas narrative will come to an end. So Matthew 2. In the time of King Herod, remembering Luke focuses on Augustus Caesar. Matthew focuses on Herod. The time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem asking, "Where is the child who's been born King of the Jews?" We had a lot of information in chapter 1 about that title, King of the Jews. "For we observed his star at its rising, and have come to pay him homage," or worship. When King Herod heard this, he was frightened, and all Jerusalem with him. You don't want a despotic ruler frightened, because then they tend to do scary things themselves. Calling together all the chief priests, the scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. So probably looking for biblical text to give you an insight. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for it has been written by the prophet, 'And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people Israel.'" And of course, that's a quotation from the prophet. "Then Herod secretly called for the wise men and learned from them the exact time when the star has appeared, not the location, the time. And of course, this business of determining how old this child is by the star is going to play a role in the later part of the story. He then sent the wise men, or the magi, to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word, so that I may also go and pay him homage or worship." And we know what kind of homage he would be interested in. When they had heard the king, they set out. And there ahead of them went the star that they had seen at its rising, until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw that the star had stopped, they were overwhelmed with joy. On entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they knelt down and paid him homage. Then, opening their treasure chest, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they left for their own country by another road. Again, very, very familiar story. Just some observations. Like Luke, Matthew is going to carefully locate this story, the birth of Jesus, in a larger political setting. Again, we mentioned last week, Luke has one way of doing this, Matthew has another. Luke tends to focus on Caesar and the Roman Empire. Matthew tends to focus on Judea and the king, Herod. Again, in Matthew, it's not Rome. It's the Jewish king Herod that repeatedly comes up in the story. Matthew also places this distinctively Jewish story on the broader world stage, not by introducing Augustus Caesar, but by introducing people coming from the other direction, the Magi coming from the east. Now, with all deference to the song, they are Magi. There are not three, and they're not kings. In the Middle Ages, there became an elaborate sort of, as it says, history abhors a vacuum. So people just fill in the details creatively. And not only do the three kings have names, they have whole pedigrees, you know, their family, and we know their pets. It just becomes very, very elaborate. As he did in the genealogy and in the virgin birth story, Matthew again connects Jesus, the Jewish Messiah, to the Gentiles. What's important for Matthew is that they are from the east. In other words, they are from outside the land of Palestine, and therefore they do not belong to God's people, Israel. They're foreigners, or the Jewish word for foreigner, an outsider would be, of course, Gentile. Later, we mentioned this last week, Matthew will tell us that Jesus is from the Galilee of the Gentiles. You do that in chapter 4. Now, Matthew's message is that Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, but he is born with a Gentile heritage, a lineage for women. He is from Galilee of the Gentiles. And later, when Matthew narrates the beginning of Jesus' ministry in Galilee, Matthew is going to once again remind us of Jesus' connection to the Gentiles as he quotes Isaiah, "Land of Zebulun, land of Naphtali," some of the northern tribes up there in the Galilee area, "on the road by the sea, across the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who sit in darkness have seen a great light, and for those who sit in the region of shadow of death, light was dawned." Some of you may know that's a passage we use almost every Christmas story. Now, Jesus had a mandate from God, according to Matthew, to bring light, justice, and hope specifically to the Gentiles. Even though he's the Jewish Messiah, it's important for Matthew that Jesus has a role. And, you know, in other words, this is not just the Apostle Paul, but Jesus himself is seen through the eyes of Matthew as expanding the covenant with God's people to the entire world. And now, of course, in Matthew's gospel, the first to worship Jesus are Gentiles from the East. So this is a theme that Matthew's been developing, kind of a little drumbeat. The prophecy from Isaiah makes it clear that including the Gentiles was all a part of God's plan from the beginning. That's why you want to quote a prophet. That's why you want to connect it to a prophetic voice. It means this is not a new thing. This is an old thing. It's a God thing, something that God had always intended. Now, this message is then symbolically reinforced by the star. The Gentiles who sat or sat in darkness with regard to God now follow the star, the light of the star, to the manger. The star is celestial, meaning, and this is true in the ancient world of all peoples, stars were understood to be moved by the power of God. Anything in the heavens was godly. It is the star that brings the Gentiles to Jesus. Translation, in Isaiah's language, the Gentiles who sit in darkness have now seen a great light, and Matthew provides that light in the form of the star. On them, light is shown. And now they follow that the light of that star right up to the manger. Now, Matthew's symbolism is very clear. It is God who is bringing the Gentiles to Jesus, just as God had always intended. You may remember in the book of Acts and in the letters of Paul, this is a highly contentious and debatable issue. Paul extends the mission to the Gentiles, the church in Jerusalem with James and others, and even Barnabas, opposed this. And as a matter of fact, we have the great showdown at the council in Jerusalem. And then after that, we have the incident in Antioch, in which Paul is defeated. And Paul eventually leaves Palestine, going over to Greece and Turkey, simply because the church in Jerusalem, the traditional wing of the Christian faith, really understands that to be a believer in Jesus, you have to be a Jew, which means you have to convert, have to go through circumcision, all of that. So here we have that other voice being heard. As was with the case with Luke, the whole passage, once again, is political. And imperial Roman symbols for Caesar. The terms Lord and Son of God, which Luke uses repeatedly, remember, in both chapters 1 and 2, for Jesus in the birth narrative, terms that put Jesus in conflict with Caesar and Rome, strikingly, are nowhere to be found in Matthew's narrative. They're just not there, totally missing. Instead, Matthew introduces us to another title that would also have special significance to Rome, the King of the Jews. This title was given to Herod the Great by the people and the Senate of Rome, actually by Caesar and the Senate of Rome. And this title brings Jesus into direct conflict with another who bears the same title. So just as Son of God is a title that Romans were using for Caesar and Christians were using for Jesus, sets up a dynamic of conflict, in the same way, but with a different title, the idea that Jesus is Messiah, which literally means king, anointed, and the fact that Rome has already anointed another person king of the Jews, again, we set up a conflict. It's set up differently, but it's the same conflict. 42 BC, Augustus and the Roman Senate awarded Herod title King of the Jews, allowing him to govern on their behalf. Now, as Luke does, Matthew parallels one king to another. We saw that in Luke, and it was just a series of parallels. Matthew is a very similar series. You know, it's different in wording, but the idea is the same. We've got one king paralleling another. One king Jesus, the other king Herod. Both had the title King of the Jews. That's problematic. One is given that title by Rome. One is given that title by God. Both are kings, both have kingdoms, both rule. Exactly like in Luke, but with language shift. This raises the question, as it did in the Gospel of Luke, who is the real king of the Jews? Or in Luke it was, who is the true Son of God? In both Gospels, a conflict is unavoidable. The words Messiah and King are so closely anointed because God's King is the anointed one, the Messiah, so that the word anointed came to be a euphemism for king, and the two terms actually, yeah, could be used interchangeably. Really, Messiah, King, and anointed, the three terms could be used interchangeably. So for example, we have in Psalm 18, great triumphs he gives to his king, this is speaking about God, and shows steadfast love to his anointed, this is Hebraic parallelism, because the king is the anointed, to David and his descendants forever. So king, anointed, David. You may remember in the genealogy, we had that kind of repetition as well. In Hebrew, the word for the promised and future king, the one who will be anointed as Messiah, and the title King of the Jews will be the charge under which Jesus will be crucified. The title will be nailed on the titulus above his head. So it's Jesus Nazareth Rex Iudoi, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. That's the charge by which Jesus will actually be executed. Now, this is no ordinary king. He has a star. And interestingly, let's see what you want to do with this. We're looking at a Roman coin, and it has a star on it. And if you can see the star there, it has a little bit of a flame, which means that actually it's a comet. When Julius Caesar was assassinated at about that time, Augustus Caesar, there was actually a comet that appeared in the sky, and part of the Augustus Caesar sort of publicity, his propaganda, was that this meant that Julius Caesar, who had been assassinated, was ascending to heaven to be a god, and therefore it was his star. Interestingly, there is another comet that appeared right about the time Augustus Caesar died many years later, and Tiberius, Augustus Caesar's successor, also said the same thing and also coined a coin. So two Caesars who, not at their births, but at their deaths, have a star. According to Roman theology, a star appears in the heaven, a comet, declaring them to be a god. So with the birth of Jesus, we again have a star. In the ancient world, anything in the heavens was a big deal. Something new, a big deal. A star, a meteor, whatever. Now, I know we love natural explanations, but let's just go with this, okay? This is no ordinary star. Is it Jupiter and Saturn aligning with each other? Probably not. Why? Well, this star travels. It stops, it starts, and it points. No natural phenomenon that we know of fits that description. So obviously in the story, this is intended to say this is not an ordinary star. This is a supernatural event. This is something that God is doing. Because of this unusual star's movements, the Magi have now come to pay homage and worship. I think you guys probably already know this, but in the Persian area, and today which would be Iraq, the Zoroastrian religion, and not just then, people all over the ancient world, watching the stars was a very big deal. So people watched the stars, and when there was something unusual in the heavens, generally this had meaning, it had an interpretation, and following the line of this story, the Magi interpret that something is going to happen in the west from where they are, assuming the star appears in the west, and so now they have followed the star to find out what that is. Of course, they say in the story that they already know that the star symbolizes the birth of the king of the Jews. Now, to be honest, one of the largest Jewish populations in the world lives in that area. The largest group was in Alexandria, Egypt. And I'm not sure which, either Palestine or the old Babylon, both have very large Jewish populations. So some knowledge of the Jewish traditions would be not unusual at all. This news of another king who is to be worshipped threatens Herod. And what threatens Herod, we know from Josephus and other sources, must be destroyed. His wife threatened him, he killed her. Some of his children threatened him, he killed them. His in-laws were a threat, he killed them. The entire family of his wife was a threat, he killed them. So Herod was known historically for being extremely paranoid and being a person who would strike first. And Augustus Caesar said, true statement, he would rather be Herod's pig than Herod's relative because he thought he would live longer. Now, the inquiry as to where the Messiah king will be born leads to yet another Davidic connection. Remember, Matthew's just laying those down rapid fire. Bethlehem, the traditional city of David, the city where David was born, the city where a prophet said the new David, the Messiah, would be born. And now we're zeroing in on Bethlehem. This is where Micah said that the one who is to rule Israel will come from Israel, both the original David and, of course, the new David. Now, as Luke did, Matthew is paralleling one king with another. In this case, King Herod, King Jesus. Again, both have the same title, King of Jews, given by Rome, given by their God, kings, kingdoms, rule, right down. The wise men then present symbolic gifts to the child. Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. You know the song, you sang it in Sunday school. Now, traditionally, going back to the Middle Ages, when any detail that was unknown was automatically filled in, these three gifts symbolize the three roles or the three offices of Jesus. King, priest, and prophet. Gold was understood as being symbolic of kingship. Who has the gold? The king has the gold. Frankincense is one of the things that's burned as incense in worship. So this could be seen as symbolic of Jesus being a priest who mediates between God and the human race, like the letter of Hebrews says in other scriptures. Myrrh is an oil used in the anointing of prophets. It was also used in embalming and can be understood as foreshadowing Jesus' death. These views are all found in later Christian tradition. There's some actually very long writings that lay this out. But in Matthew, this is a guess, but the best guess is that these gifts probably don't have quite that elaborate deal. They probably have a much simpler explanation. They're all incredibly expensive. Therefore, they are gifts worthy of a king. Who does Matthew keep telling us Jesus is? He's king of the Jews, of the line of David, the Messiah. So these are gifts suitable for a king. With that, now Matthew moves to a transitional story, the flight to Egypt. After they had left, an angel of the Lord, remember in Matthew, in Luke, it's always dreams. Everything's a dream. God works through dreams. In Matthew, it's all angels. Six of one, half a dozen another. Same thing. God comes to us. God is mediated through angels, through dreams. Angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. And Matthew also, it always happens to Joseph. In Luke, it always happens to Mary. So these are just differences in style. The angel said to Joseph, get up, take the child and his mother, flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you. Why? For Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him. Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother by night, went to Egypt, and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken through the Lord, by the Lord through the prophet, out of Egypt I've called my son. Of course, that's not a prophecy, but you know, for Matthew it is. Now, Matthew's comment that Herod was frightened by the coming birth of Jesus is more than enough reason, to think he's in danger. However, there's probably something else going on in the story. As a writer, Matthew is using a literary device called typology. In typology, one figure is similar to or is compared to another historical figure, and their lives are paralleled. In other words, it's a type. You got two figures that fit the same type. Matthew famously uses Moses typology. Matthew is going to parallel Jesus with Moses over and over and over. Not only is Jesus a Davidic figure, another type, the Messiah, the King of the Jews, he's also a Moses figure. So both Jesus and Moses have to flee an evil king, Pharaoh, who seeks their lives when they're babies. Both are then called out of Egypt and into the promised land. Both will be lawgivers. Both will ascend the mountain and come down with God's law. Moses goes up Mount Sinai. Jesus does the Sermon on the Mount. So that's what it means. That's what typology means, is that you're going to portray a second figure, but you're going to do a lot of parallels so that the people reading the story are not just hearing the new story, they're also hearing the old story. They're hearing these echoes. So it's, one of the traditions of Judaism at this time was that when the Messiah came, he would be, this is a quote, a prophet like Moses. And so Matthew gives that. And that phrase is actually used in the gospel several times. Now, for those of us who would love to know, Matthew is going to frustrate us. Matthew shows absolutely zero interest in what happens in Egypt. So what do we know about what happened in Egypt? We know absolutely nothing, because he didn't tell us. All that's important is that God warns Joseph, and Joseph is obedient. That's all that matters. More importantly, that Jesus is coming back out of Egypt, once again for Matthew, fulfills the scripture. And then that, of course, sets up the final scene. It is one of the most horrific scenes in the Bible. It is known as the slaughter of the innocents and tradition of Bethlehem. So in Matthew 2, we have this. When Herod saw that he had been tricked by the wise man, he was infuriated. He sent and killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had learned from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. Again, this is not a prophecy. This is something else. But again, Matthew sees it as a prophecy. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing and loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. This is actually an Old Testament story. She refused to be consoled because they were no more. Now, two and under. Best guess, again, this is a guess, Matthew probably wants us to understand that this event takes place around 2 years after Jesus is born. Now, we have no independent historical verification that this event ever happened. However, it is totally in character with what Herod would likely do. And the other thing is, it's the kind of event that probably, even, you know, if you could nail it down historically, would probably have never been recorded. Bethlehem's a small town. We're not talking about large numbers of children. There were probably just a handful of children that were done. So this is not the kind of thing that, again, gets in history books. But the real question is why this event is in the Christmas story of all things. Clearly for Matthew, this event is central. It's the climax of the story. Remember, traditionally, the two places that are the most important in any story is the beginning and the end, and particularly the end. Whatever the author wants to leave you with. In Luke, we're left with Simeon and Anna, both of whom are saying that this child is the fulfillment of the hopes of Israel for what God will bring. Matthew's climax is very different. Matthew is doing two things in these two closing scenes. First, he is once again using Moses' typology. What happened in Exodus? Well, Moses tried to kill all the children. Pharaoh tried to kill all the children. Matthew clearly sees Jesus as a new Moses sent by God, once again, just like Moses, to deliver his people out of bondage. Now there's a new Pharaoh who seeks to kill the new Moses, just as in the Exodus story. The other thing is Matthew's doing, and this is once again, Luke does the same thing, but gets there in a different way. He's showing us Jesus's destiny. In other words, what he's really doing is he's pointing forward. Even as we have the birth story, we're pointing forward to where we know the story will end. Just as Luke does, Matthew is going to place the cross in the crash. Matthew reminds us, this is not just a cute story about the birth of a baby. This is the story about who this baby will become, how this baby will be opposed as an adult, and what it means to be the Messiah, the Son of God. We then have this. When Herod died, an angel of the Lord, always in Matthew, it's an angel, never a dream. Angel of the Lord suddenly appears in a dream. I'm sorry, got to hear both. Joseph in Egypt and said, get up, take the child and his mother, go to the land of Israel, for those who are seeking the child's life are dead. Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother and returned to Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus, when Herod died, the kingdom is carved up among Herod's sons. Archelaus gets Judea. Herod Antipas gets Galilee and Perea. Philip gets the Decapolis. When he heard that Archelaus was ruling over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. After being warned again in a dream, he went away to the district of Galilee, where he made his home in the town of Nazareth. Now in Luke, they're from Galilee. They go to Bethlehem. They return to Galilee. In Matthew, they're not from Galilee. Their home is in Bethlehem. They go to Egypt and they come back, but it's still not safe. So now they go to Galilee. So that what had been spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled. And once again, this is not a prophecy, but for Matthew, it's a prophecy. It will be called a Nazarene. Now on the return, another dream warns them not to go to Judah. Instead, we're going to go to Nazareth, which is how we get Jesus of Nazareth. Dreams play a role in Matthew, like angels in Luke. Both are really euphemisms for God's activity. When you're talking about angels and dreams, we're talking about the information is coming from God. One last time, Matthew reminds us that God's hand is on everything that's happening. And Luke, the family was from Nazareth, returned to Nazareth at the birth. The only reason they're in Bethlehem was the census. In Matthew, they are natives of Bethlehem. They do not need a manger because, if you remember in the story, they have a house in Bethlehem. They wind up in Nazareth because they are warned not to return home. Do not go back to Bethlehem. For Matthew, again, fulfills a prophecy. Now, we don't know of any such prophecy, but here's a couple of guesses as to what might have been going through Matthew's deal. It's possible that he's referring to a passage from Judges that says this: you shall conceive and bear a son, and the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from birth to the day of his death. Okay? That's the kind of thing Matthew would look for. Of course, the problem is that's not only not a messianic prophecy, it's just the narrative of the birth of Samuel. But, you know, it would be enough for Matthew. More likely, Matthew's thinking of a phonetic similarity with the Hebrew word Neser. Neser means branch. Remember Isaiah, a branch shall come off the shoot of Jesse. And is the word used in the messianic title in the book of Isaiah. So in Isaiah 11, we have there, a shoot shall come out of the stump of Jesse. Jesse is the father of David, and a branch, Neser, shall grow out of his roots. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest on him. So this kind of language, as we've seen this in the baptism and other places, this is the kind of thing that Isaiah could look at, and for Isaiah, this would be a clear prophecy. Since Matthew seems to see any and all prophecies and promises being fulfilled in Jesus, a phonetic similarity, possibly, we don't know for sure, could be all took. He doesn't quote what he's referring to, but there's a couple things he could be referring to. More importantly, the reference to the quote being a prophecy fits Matthew's larger vision of dreams and prophecies. Dreams and prophecies are woven throughout the entire story, reminding us this is God's job. This is God's hand that it works. And with this, the prologue of the Gospel of Matthew is finished, and it simply begins. From there, we move to the baptism of Jesus and his ministry.